Campus FM presents a talk by Professor Michele Pistone, organized by the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice. The talk is entitled, How Should the Church Sound Its Voice in the Tower of Babel? Perspective on the Church's Social Message.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is my pleasure to welcome you this evening on behalf of the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice for this public lecture by Professor Michele Pistone. This is the first public activity since our center was thrust into the limelight for its work on racism and xenophobia and the violence that the publication of our report seems to have unleashed. So I would like to take this opportunity to thank you and the many others who have expressed their sympathy and solidarity with us and with the Jesuit community after these painful events. Your support is a source of great strength for us. It makes us feel that we are not alone in our work, and it enables us to renew our commitment for a society that is tolerant of differences because it believes in the dignity of each and every human being. Let us not forget, moreover, to make the link between the violence that occurred and the apparent reason behind it. We trust that what happened will serve as a wake-up call for those in our society who hold human dignity at heart, and it will lead us to take a firmer stand against any racist tendencies that might be raising their heads among us and even perhaps within us. It should push us towards more positive action in favor of human dignity and against all forms of discrimination. A small poster hangs in my office, put there by my predecessor, Father Pierre Grecq-Margrat, and I would share what's written there. Perhaps many of you have already heard it, written by Pastor Martin Niemöller, victim of the Nazis. He said, in Germany, first they came for the communists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a communist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a Jew. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I wasn't a trade unionist. Then they came for the Catholics, and I didn't speak out because I was a Protestant. Then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak out for me. For the last years, our center has been committed to spreading the Church's Catholic social message and the holding of courses in Catholic social teaching in parishes and in other community groups features regularly in our annual program. So we are very happy to have Professor Michele Pistone with us this evening to speak to us about the Church's contribution to the public discussion going on in our own times. Today, there are so many voices clamoring for attention as we all try to press our views on the global debate. In the din, it is almost impossible to speak clearly, let alone listen calmly, intelligently, and actively to what others are trying to say. We now have our very own Tower of Babel. The public role of religion has long been hotly debated, and now more so than ever, when it is often accused of being at the root of so much tension and conflict. Perhaps religion should retreat to a quiet place of prayerful meditation and leave the rest of the world in peace. Perhaps the world would be a better place if only religion was left out of public and political discussion. However, the public church has always expressed its right and even its duty to participate in the global discussion. Our religion has a long history of addressing humanity's toughest issues, the dignity of life, the fundamental freedoms, the cruel results of poverty and social exclusion, and so many other fundamental human problems. So what does the Catholic Church's rich and wide-ranging social teaching contribute to our Tower of Babel? Is this contribution necessarily based on faith in God? And if it is this intelligible only to those who share the Christian persuasion? What is specific to the Church's contribution to the Tower of Babel? How should the Church sound its voice in the Tower of Babel? This is the question Michele Pistone will engage with this evening. Michel Pistone is professor of law and director of the clinical program at Villanova University School of Law. She also directs and teaches at the Clinic for Asylum, Refugee and Immigrant Services. At present, during this semester, she is a Fulbright Scholar at the Faculty of Law at our university. Professor Pistone has published widely in the areas of immigration and Catholic social teaching. Her forthcoming book, Stepping Out of the Brain Drain, Applying Catholic Social Teaching in a New Era of Migration, combines these interests, and is due to be released in early autumn of this year. Her other publications include articles in the Harvard Human Rights Journal, the Georgetown Immigration Law Journal, the Journal of Catholic Social Thought, and the chapter in Marriage of Undocumented Residents, a book published by the Canon Law Society of America. Before teaching at Villanova, Professor Pistone taught at the Georgetown University Law Center and served as the acting legal director for a human rights lawyers group, Human Rights First. Professor Pistone also serves as the director of the Pennsylvania Immigration Resource Center. However, I will not take any more of your time, and I would like to invite Professor Pistone to deliver her talk. Afterwards, there will be time for questions.
Thanks. It's a great honor to be here tonight. I must say that I appreciate very much the introduction by Father Paul. It was very touching. I also like to thank Father Paul for inviting me to speak here tonight and for helping me with coming up with the topic of this lecture. And he's also shown me a lot of great kindnesses in the short time I've been here in Malta. As I mentioned, I've been here in Malta for a short time. I'm actually here for, this is the eighth week of a six-month stay. And I'm here on a Fulbright scholarship. And the Fulbright Scholars Program is a program funded by the U.S. government. It's designed to expose U.S. scholars to other countries and to expose foreign scholars to the U.S. That being said, believe it or not, I'm still, even though I've been here for 8 weeks, I'm still not an expert on Malta. I have a little knowledge, but a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. Last summer, I came here for a little vacation because I wanted to see what Malta was about and prepare for coming for the 6 months. And I was here for 10 days. It was in July. It was hot. And the one thing I learned when I was here was that when I came back for this day, I wanted to live on the shore. Because, did I mention, it was hot. So when we came, my daughter, my husband, and I looked for a flat on the Sliema front. And we wanted to be on the shady side because we wanted to not, you know, so that we wouldn't suffer in the heat. And you know what? It's worked. Many times since we arrived, we've sat on our balcony, huddled in our winter coats, marveling at how unhot we are. Unhot, of course, is a euphemism for freezing cold. And so a little knowledge can be a dangerous thing. I mention this all because my views tonight are on a topic, the content of the church's social message. And of course, my views are influenced by my experience in the United States, an experience of more years or even decades than I'd like to admit. As I thought through tonight's talk, one of the things I wondered is whether some of the conclusions that I'll come to tonight might be different if I were looking at things from a uniquely Maltese perspective. Malta is a little different from the United States. As many of you might know, Professor Ian Raffalo, he is the dean of the Faculty of Law at the University of Malta, where I'm lecturing this semester. And I was privileged a few weeks ago to have lunch at his house in Lea. And while we were there, he explained to my husband, as I looked out on the balcony of his house, they were looking at the church behind the house, and it was the old church. It was built in the 1400s. While the new church in Lea was built in 1694. Now, this is a combination of words, new and 1694, that you just don't hear in the United States. In 1694, well, there was no United States. And this difference in this different sense of the scope of history is only one of a series of differences between Malta and the US. The size of the two countries, the size of their respective populations, the relative ethnic and religious homogeneity of those populations, etc., etc., etc. It would not surprise me if those differences resulted in a distinctive Maltese perspective on what I'm going to be talking about tonight. What exactly that distinctive perspective might be, however, I'm not quite sure I know, any more than I knew how cold the wind could get on the Sliema front in the winter. But that distinctive perspective is something that we might all think about tonight, and I would in fact appreciate hearing later your views on how the Maltese perspective might suggest a modification of the ideas that I expressed tonight. So, on to those ideas. I want to start very briefly with a short discussion of the foundational question of whether the church should sound its voice at all in the public square. The role of religious beliefs in political life is a contentious subject among many people. Many people get very upset when religious beliefs are invoked to establish a political point or garner political support. In fact, the mere mention of God by a politician or government official sometimes is controversial. In America, you may know, it's quite common for politicians to end speeches with the phrase, "God bless America." In certain parts of Europe, at least, the voicing of a similar phrase by a politician is inconceivable. Prime Minister Tony Blair, for example, is said to have generated tremendous opposition within his own party when he planned to end a speech with a similar phrase. And of course, a few weeks ago, a political firestorm of sorts was created when the Prime Minister said that ultimately God would be the judge of his decision to invade Iraq. Religious organizations also sometimes face criticism when they voice their views in the public square. Many people believe that, as a matter of political morality, or even as a matter of legal prescription, that religious views should be kept out of the political marketplace, that religious perspectives should not play a role in public discourse. That doesn't mean that issues of all kinds cannot be debated. It just means that the arguments must be based on what is called either secular reason or public reason. That is, political issues must be debated and decided according to reasons that are shared by all members of the public. So, for example, here in Malta, except for restaurants and hotels, I noticed that all stores are closed on Sunday. I don't know whether this is by law or by custom, but when I was a child in the United States, it was actually the same way. We had the same situation. Stores were closed, and they were closed because of laws in most states called blue laws. Don't ask me why they were called blue laws. I don't know. There are a few theories, but no one really knows. Anyway, the blue laws have mostly been repealed today. Indeed, if you visited the United States recently, you found that most stores are open on Sunday, and in fact, quite a few are open 24 hours a day. So if you ever need a new hammer or a jar of strawberry jam at 3 in the morning, you can get it. It's convenient, but there's a price to be paid. Now, suppose that you thought that that price was too high and wanted to reinstitute the blue laws, so at least to close the stores on Sunday. Well, it violates the principle of public reason and secular reason to argue that the stores should be closed because, for example, God established the seventh day as a day of rest. On the other hand, you could argue that less commercial activity on Sunday will help to bring families together because parents won't be working on that day, or would help to bring communities together because people would be able to go to community events that were planned on a Sunday. Or would even help with public safety because needed maintenance of various types may be easier to do if most workplaces were closed one day a week. Now, these rationales all satisfy the principle of public and secular reason. And public and secular reasoning is better, it is argued, maybe even so much better, that religious arguments should be restricted in the public square. There are two reasons for this. First, such arguments are publicly accessible in a way that religious arguments are not. And second, such arguments have an element of fairness that religious arguments lack. Let's start with the first, public accessibility. To go back to the blue laws, everyone can argue, for example, whether or not closing the stores on Sunday will help to bring about family togetherness. Even if it does, maybe the blue laws should still be opposed because they might lead to a loss of jobs and therefore hurt some families, particularly poor families. Maybe the blue laws should be opposed because they increase congestion during most days by squeezing all the commercial activity into a 6 rather than a 7-day week. I'm not endorsing any of these arguments either way. I'm just making the point that secular arguments can easily be met by secular counterarguments. But on the other hand, how does one argue against the assertion that stores should be closed on Sunday because God wants to keep that day as a day of rest? It seems impossible to rebut on a wholly secular basis. Indeed, in a religiously diverse country, it's even impossible to argue on a religious basis. Because some religions celebrate their Sabbath on a Saturday, and even some have their main prayer services on Friday. So indeed, the absence of a shared form of reasoning can make public debate empty, as if it were being conducted in two different languages, where, unlike Malta, people only speak one. This lack of accessibility, it is argued, makes public debate based on non-secular principles also unfair to those who don't speak the language of religion. Citizen participation is the keystone of liberal democracy, and arguments that are not generally accessible make it difficult for the non-religious to participate. This is deemed to be unfair, especially when the end result is a coercive law of some kind. That, at least, is in brief form the argument against invoking religious ideas in the public square. For me, however, it's not that difficult an issue. My view is that ideas from all quarters should be welcomed in the public square. In response to the unfairness argument, I would point out that most law is coercive in one way or another. Religious persons can be subject to coercive laws that are deemed equally unfair. For example, in the United States, I come from the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was founded by William Penn, a famous English Quaker, as a sanctuary protecting freedom of conscience. And Pennsylvania still has a very large Quaker influence, more so than any other state in the United States. Well, traditionally, Quakers are pacifists. It's a tenet of their religion. But in the past, Quakers have gone to prison for resisting the military draft, which we no longer have, during wartime. If it is unfair to force someone to close his store on Sunday because the law is based on a religious belief he does not hold, it is certainly as unfair to imprison someone for refusing to act in violation of a belief he does hold. That's not to say that the unfairness is not a necessary evil. It just means that the unfairness rationale for restricting religious speech in the public square might prove too much because it's too broad. Unfair doesn't automatically mean unwise or unnecessary or unconstitutional. So you need more. An adherence of restricting religious discourse in the public square say, well, we have more, the public accessibility rationale. But this rationale always struck me as deeply problematic. It essentially says to a particular group in society, your best argument is illegitimate. You can't or shouldn't make it. It's the equivalent of trying to win a chess match by sweeping all the chess pieces off the table. That's not a good way to win a chess match, and of course it's not a good way to conduct public debate. First of all, by insisting a whole category of argument is illegitimate, as the public accessibility rationale does, it reduces public argument to a type of kabuki theater. Religious people are allowed to strike secular poses, they can posture in ways deemed acceptable by convention, but they can't take off their makeup, by voicing what their opinions are really based on. In my view, with religious beliefs and motivations permeating so deeply through so many societies, calls to restrict religiously motivated political speech really amount to a call for inauthentic public debate. I don't think this is a healthy way for society. Nor do I accept the premise that only secular speech is publicly accessible. Of course, religious argument is accessible. As that word is commonly understood, it's understandable. It's just not accepted in some quarters. Well, that's fine. Different opinions are what make discourse valuable. But it seems somewhat arrogant to proclaim in advance that arguments that move millions and even billions of people can't possibly move you. In this case, I agree with Professor Stephen Carter from the Yale Law School, who wrote in his interesting book, The Culture of Disbelief, How American Law and Politics Trivialize Religious Devotion, that political discourse should welcome arguments from religious tradition as it welcomes every useful, thoughtful voice. Not because their epistemological suppositions are universally shared, but because even those with very different epistemologies might learn or teach. So in my view, the only fair approach is to apply the same standard to all public arguments. All arguments are permissible and can be attacked on their substance and rejected or accepted on their merits. It's better for person A to argue in favor of the death penalty based on an eye for an eye, and for person B to argue against it based on Jesus's command to turn the other cheek, than it would be to silence them both. So on this complicated matter, I end up with a pretty simple bottom line. More interesting for me and more difficult than whether public arguments should be made in the public square is how they should be made, particularly how they should be made by religious organizations and particularly by the Catholic Church. It's to this topic that I'll devote the rest of my talk. Now, just to be clear, the title of my talk here promises perspectives on the content of the church's social message. Well, there are many ways for the church to proclaim its social message in the public square. In one sense, a very real sense, the church proclaims its social message when it proclaims the gospel. It also proclaims, loudly proclaims, I would say, its social message through its actions, by, for example, providing direct services of one kind or another to the poor, to immigrants, and to others. I've worked with many groups doing this work, including Catholic Charities, Catholic Relief Services, my own parish back home, and of course, Jesuit Refugee Services here, among others. And I've always been very impressed by the dedication of the people involved and the positive example they provide in doing their good works. But tonight I won't be talking about the content of the church's social message as it is proclaimed through the good works of the church or through the gospel. Rather, I'll be talking about the church's social message as it is articulated in the church's social teachings. By social teaching, I mean the body of the church's teaching about social, political, and economic issues that relate to issues of the day. In the sense I'm talking about, the church has been commenting on economic, social, and political issues through its social teaching, dating back to 1891, with the publication of Pope Leo XIII's encyclical letter, Rerum Novarum. And since then, Catholic social teaching has dealt with such issues as immigration, human rights, economic development, and a lot of others. There's no definitive list of all documents that comprise Catholic social teaching, but they generally include certain encyclicals, certain speeches written by popes on social issues, certain documents issued by the Second Vatican Council, and pastoral letters and other statements authorized by congregations for bishops. An example of statements by congregations for bishops at the national level include the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops pastoral letter called Welcoming the Stranger Among Us, Unity in Diversity. At the bilateral or regional level, the U.S. and Mexican bishops co-authored the pastoral letter entitled Strangers No Longer, Together on a Journey of Hope. And at the international level, that's the 2004 document, The Love of Christ Toward Migrants. Typically, Catholic social teaching is general in nature. Broad questions are posed, and the responses are usually framed in the context of a few general principles. Some very informed students of the social teaching have expressed some ambivalence with this state of affairs. Let me read you a quotation from one of them. It's by Father William Byron. He is a former president of the Catholic University of America and a Jesuit. And it's from an article he wrote called The Future of Catholic Social Thought. Here, Father Byron stated that, in Catholic social teaching, the question is always general, so is the response. Whatever the question, the answer is usually framed in a few general principles, accompanied by several guidelines for programs consistent with the principles. He goes on to say, for a universal teaching church, this is the way it has to be, I suppose. When it comes, however, to the future of Catholic social teaching, I cannot help but wonder whether the times might not require more precision of the church and its teachers, if Catholic social thought is to have greater, even decisive, impact. Well, let's explore if this is the way it has to be. In fact, there are many sound reasons for the church to avoid detail in its teachings. One main reason is very practical. While the church's resources are substantial, they are limited. Reality, however, is complicated and ever-changing. Very intelligent people can find enough surprises in the life of an ant to last a lifetime. How much harder is it to understand humankind and its complicated social structures? And if one is to suggest policy advice of some kind, it cannot be forgotten that the possibility of unintended consequences is ever lurking. Difficulties caused by these facts are compounded by the church's universal mission. As a universal church, its message ideally is meant to apply to communities large and small, poor and rich, around the entire world. But the more universal the aspiration, the more difficult it is to be specific. A related practical problem in developing a very specific and concrete social message is that very often crucial facts may be uncertain. When this is so, taking Catholic social teaching seriously means requiring discipline in its exercise to minimize the risk of inadvertent error. And the increased possibility of error brings up a second reason the church might wisely avoid specificity in its teaching. Not only is it often simply practical to do so, it is also often the prudent thing to do. Catholics are obliged to consider the social teaching seriously in the formation of their consciences, and it is to some degree binding on all Catholics. Should the church speak prematurely on an issue or without full understanding of the facts, it risks undermining the authority it claims. Under these circumstances, it is appropriately prudent to take the utmost care before speaking, even to the point of remaining silent on some matters of intense public interest. Taking all of the practical and the prudential concerns into consideration, I think it is understandable that the church's formal social teaching maintain a general character. Certainly at the highest levels of the universal church, it is difficult to conclude that the social teaching could be very specific. Yet, as Father Byron suggested, there may be some advantages to a more concrete social teaching. The two main advantages fall into two categories, one substantive and the other structural. The substantive advantage is self-evident. By identifying and advocating for concrete change on the express basis of Catholic social teaching, the church can better help to bring about such change. If you are never specific about what you want, you can't be surprised if you don't get it. Conversely, if you are specific, sometimes you'll be surprised that you get exactly what you want. The potential structural advantages to a more specific social teaching would be no less real. As Catholic social teaching gains in concreteness, by necessity, its development will require greater interaction with the laity of the church, and indeed with all people of goodwill. And I think this would be a very positive development. More involvement by the laity could first help with regard to identification of issues. The needs of the present time emerge from changes in the fields of science, of technology, of economics, from political innovations, and from worldwide political and economic interdependence. Those in the laity who work more directly and most intensively in these fields will often be the first to identify new issues that could benefit from a Catholic social teaching analysis. If the Church's social teaching is to provide more specific answers, it will first have to ask more specific questions. And if it is to do so in the most productive manner, it will have to ask the questions in a timely manner. Increasing engagement by those persons best positioned to read the signs of the times in the areas from which the needs of the times emerge seems a prerequisite for accomplishing this aim. Moreover, once the questions are defined, devising appropriately concrete answers will require a continued reaching out to the laity by the magisterium, the teaching organs of the Church. The benefits of doing this in an increased way are twofold. First, the immediate result, that is, the formation of a more specific teaching, are likely to be improved by the process of outside consultation. Indeed, the more specific the teaching is, the more difficult, even impossible, it would be to develop without outside consultation. Second, as it becomes more apparent that the Church is reaching out, the increased level of engagement would likely increase enthusiasm for Catholic social teaching among those who are best positioned to provide the Church advice for concretely addressing the needs of the times. As Father Byron has stated, a teaching Church, not simply content with, but committed to listening and learning before it speaks out on social issues, would stimulate great intellectual activity in Catholic circles by inviting Catholics and other scholars to reflect upon and articulate the significant social questions in the areas of their competence. The net result should be the development of a virtuous cycle of engagement, stimulating enthusiasm, stimulating better ideas, stimulating further engagement, stimulating still more enthusiasm, and on and on and on. All of these advantages may come to pass, and yet the dangers of a more specific orientation still remain. Recognizing that there are strong points to be made on both sides of the issue, my own view comes down somewhere in the middle. In my view, papal encyclicals and other documents coming out of the Vatican probably should continue to focus on the more general and universal aspects of Catholic social teaching. Papal and Vatican endorsements of particular solutions put the prestige, credibility, and authority of the Church and Catholic social teaching at greatest risk. On the other hand, I think there is an opportunity for national and sometimes even regional organizations of bishops to pursue, albeit with great prudence and appropriate selectivity, a more concrete social teaching. I think that much good could come of this. One of the great goods would be to help change Catholic social teaching status as it is often called, the Church's best kept secret. The more specific the social teaching is, the more it is likely to resonate with both members of the public who would be directly affected by the concrete proposals and with members of the news media who are constitutionally more disposed towards discussing concrete proposals, who, what, where, when, why, than more rarefied topics. Take immigration, for example. Even though I've been here for only 8 weeks, even I know that this is a topic that the newspapers and everyone else in Malta might have more than a slight interest in. It's actually a topic that's the subject of intense interest almost everywhere. In fact, in the United States, a controversy has just developed over proposed legislation that would restrict immigration. The American Catholic Church has taken a strong stand against the proposal. Really, it's leading the opposition, which has actually led some people to call for the Church to be denied some of the tax exemptions that religious organizations benefit from in the United States. The highly charged nature of some of the rhetoric we hear is, to some extent, understandable. For there is no doubt that the immigration issue everywhere is an important one, with serious political, economic, cultural, and ethical dimensions and ramifications. By and large, though, I find myself in agreement with what the church has to say about the topic. The church views immigration issues as it views most issues in its social teaching, through the fundamental principles of human dignity and the common good. Every human being possesses human dignity. It's a gift of creation. And human beings can flourish and develop only in community with others. Indeed, as the Second Vatican Council stated, man's social nature makes it evident that the progress of the human person and the advance of society itself hinges on each other. How does the church apply these fundamental principles to immigration? Well, first, it recognizes that there are different types of immigration. Refugees are regarded as having the strongest right to immigrate. By definition, their human dignity has suffered a severe assault from political or religious or racially motivated persecution. And their great need creates a correspondingly great obligation of acceptance by states. The second group of migrants recognized by Catholic social teaching, which is economic migrants, also have the right to immigrate in order to fulfill the duty to support one's family. Here, the obligation of the state to protect its borders on behalf of the common good creates more of a need for line drawing. However, in the words of the Second Congregation, the Sacred Congregation for Bishops' instruction on the pastoral care of people who migrate, political authorities unjustly deny the rights of human persons if they block or impede emigration or immigration, except where grave requirements of the common good, considered objectively, demand it. It places a relatively high burden on those who would limit economic migration, especially given that, in the words of the joint statement by the US and Mexican bishops, controls on economic migration should not be instituted merely for the purpose of acquiring additional wealth. There's also a third, less numerous category of migrants recognized by the church, highly skilled and educated migrants. And here the church is more relaxed about barriers to immigration on the theory that the migration of the elite causes harm to the development of the sending country, which is typically a less developed country. Whether that rationale holds up in a globalized economy of today is actually an interesting question and happens to be one that I explore at length in a new book that's coming out later this year called Stepping Out of the Brain Drain, which I co-authored with my husband. In all events, whether one is a refugee or an economic migrant or a highly skilled migrant, Catholic social teaching insists that all newcomers are to be treated with dignity and respect. If you wanted to summarize the church's position on the two main types of migrants, it might be helpful to think in these terms. With respect to refugees, a society must do what it must do, which is to accept and help the refugee. With respect to poor economic migrants, a society must do what it reasonably can do, which is a little less absolute of an obligation, but still a real and possibly substantial one. Now, we were talking before about how being more specific might have the advantage of making the church's social teaching, the church's best kept secret, better known, and how by making the content of its social teaching more specific, the church might be able to bring about particular changes that are in line with its social teaching. In my view, immigration is one of the best topics for reaping these advantages, especially given the church's universal reach and wide international experience. Obviously, the world over, immigration is a controversial matter. By becoming more specifically involved in it, the church will have a tremendous opportunity to teach more widely the fundamentals of Catholic social teaching. People will be listening because the discussion will take place in the context of high interest to them. Moreover, if being more specific can increase the odds that a specific preferred outcome will take place, what time is better to press this advantage than on behalf of those like refugees who are otherwise voiceless in society? That the American church has consistently done this on behalf of refugees and migrants, even in the face of substantial opposition, is one of the things I admire most about it. Of course, the journey from general exhortation to the endorsement of specific law is a complicated one and requires more than a simple invocation of the principles of human dignity and the common good. At a minimum, we have to interpret these fundamental principles in light of other teachings in Catholic social thought. We might think of human dignity in light of the church's preferential option for the poor. And we might think of common good in light of the principle of solidarity. If we do, I think we find reinforcement for the church's position that refugees and poor economic migrants properly may call upon us for assistance. For a small country like Malta, positioned as it is, in a sense, in the eye of the storm, this may seem to some to be an impossible burden. And carrying a burden of that sort is genuinely frustrating. And it can cause people to just throw up their hands in despair and say, we can't do it. But this is exactly where Catholic social teaching and the Catholic social message can prove its value. A more specific social teaching can be an antidote to the very human feeling that because we can't do everything, we're justified in doing nothing, or at least doing a lot less. The church, with its social message, can lay down a concrete marker saying, no, this much we can do, and this much we must do. Besides, to the extent a burden exists, the solution is not the rejection of Catholic social teaching, but a more complete embrace of it. In particular, I refer to the Catholic social teaching principle of subsidiarity. Subsidiarity is typically employed to push down to a more local administrative level the responsibility for addressing an issue. But it can also be used to push an issue up to a higher administrative level. This is appropriate when the issue is too large for us, the local administrators, to handle. Immigration right now might be such an issue in Malta, and it's therefore appropriate to seek assistance from, for example, the EU. I know that this effort already is being made and that Malta has been somewhat disappointed in the response so far. From what I know, I think the sense of disappointment in the EU's response is justified. That fact also can create a sense of frustration and provide a temptation to give up. Still, the social message of the church is that we must continue to do what we can do. Some time ago, I was speaking to someone who works for Catholic Relief Services, and he said that ultimately, as Catholics, we don't do what we do because of who they are, meaning the clients, but because of who we are and what we believe. In a certain sense, that is also what the articulation of the church's social message is meant to do. It helps us to define more fully what it means to be Catholic. And it really doesn't matter how big a particular problem is or what others might do in the face of it. In the context of immigration, that means that we should welcome the stranger among us with the same degree of enthusiasm and determination we demonstrate when we justifiably appeal for assistance from the larger political community in the application of the church's social teaching principle of subsidiarity. I thank you for your time, and once again, I thank Father Paul and the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice for the opportunity to talk to you tonight. I've enjoyed it very much. In closing, I could say only one more thing, and that is, as we say in the United States, God bless Malta.
Thank you, Michelle, for this very clear exposition of a very complex topic. I think we all appreciated how you started from a very theoretical starting point, and you led us to our most controversial and most practical challenge to our ideas or our life nowadays as citizens of a democratic country, as Christians, the question of how to deal with migrants and with their dignity. You said you are new, but perhaps you wouldn't know that for us, this big question, should the church speak? Should the church not speak? On what things should the church speak is a perennial discussion going on, and we always say the church has said too much, the church has said too little, the church should be more clear, the church should not be as clear. So your very clear exposition has certainly been very helpful to us. Now, I invite comments or questions, reactions. There is this roving mic. And
I feel that you've pinpointed very much the crux of the problem, in that it's... You see, if we say that whatever the church says, it's the church to say everywhere and in every situation, then it's very difficult for people to know what to do. I'm very glad that you acknowledge that Malta is in the eye of the storm. I mean, with 1.5 million refugees, one quarter of the population of Libya being refugees who want to go to Europe, and with Italy having closed its doors and having made arrangements to return them, I'm very glad that people realize how big our problem is. And it's extremely easy for the church to say, I can't take up a position about the political matter, about what Europe should do, and about whether we should open the doors or shouldn't open the doors, because that's a political thing. But every genuine Christian will realize that if you're a good Samaritan, then you can't look the other way when there's somebody who's suffering and who's come to your shore and come your way. And I think that somehow there is a great need for people who identify with the church to be shown to worry and to think about the size of the problem. Because one of the reasons why there is a danger of racism in Malta is that we feel that there's nothing that can be done, and there's actually these church people and these Jesuits who don't realize what a big problem it is and don't acknowledge the size of the problem. And if the church says, I shouldn't take up a position as a church, and the Christian community doesn't say, I don't want to, it's not my business to say it's a big problem, because I'm only here to help and I shouldn't be talking about political things, then it's very easy for other people to interpret that the church is saying that we should open up our doors and it's not a problem, and make it such an impossible thing to do. I'm very impressed, for example, that one of the most saintly people that we've had some time ago in this world was Mother Teresa. And anybody who knows anything about Mother Teresa is that Mother Teresa drew lines which she never exceeded. I was told once the story of a very poor man being taken to Mother Teresa's shelter, and then his family coming, and they said he didn't have any money at all. And she said, but it's our rule not to give money to anybody. But then he said, okay, go to such and such a square and somebody will come and give you some money. So she keeps rules, and she doesn't want her people working with her to be social workers and to train. And I think that in Malta, we, in order to be Christian, we don't have to try to solve everything, but we've got to draw lines as well. So I think you're very right. Unless the Maltese church says, this is a problem, this we can do, this we should do, this we shouldn't do, this is as far as we can go. And as a Christian community, as a Catholic community, we both acknowledge that we can't do everything and draw lines, but also say what we must do, we must do. And I think we've got great limits even with refugees. I don't think we can even think about economic immigrants in the situation in Malta. But I think it's extremely important I think your point that the Christian community should have concrete positions that it takes as a community rather than say vague things, because it can pass very much the wrong messages.
Yeah, and that's one of the things, as I said, that I admire a lot about the U.S. Catholic Church. This year in particular, as you know, immigration is a controversial issue in the United States as well as around the world. But this year in particular, the Catholic Church, a lot of organizations within the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops are working together on the immigration issue, and they've really done a very good job. They do this. They have this like movement on immigration reform. I don't know what the exact title is, But they're doing a really good job of getting the word out to Catholics around the country about what the social message is of the church and how we should be treating immigrants and how, you know, recognizing that we do need immigration reform even in the United States, but we can do it in a way that's just and that's fair and that recognizes, especially in the United States perspective, the work and contributions that so many undocumented migrants have made to our country over the years. And, you know, I think it is something that's very admirable and sometimes challenging for the church to speak out in those contexts. But the U.S. Catholic Church, at least, has found a way to do it, and I think their voice is being heard.
I like the distinction you made between refugees and economic migrants. And the idea that we have to treat, the church says that we must treat people with dignity. Now, I don't think it is treating people with dignity in Malta when we lock them up in inhuman conditions. Even if we can't afford it, I don't think it is human. And I don't think we are living as Christians. So I think there has to be the realization that even if we feel we can't afford it, we have to go beyond. And stop being naive. It's not being because we Jesuits, for example, don't know the situation, we don't live like other people. Or that the church doesn't live, you know, we don't have families of our own. I think it is impossible to say that we are Christians and to accept the inhuman conditions which we have put these people in. Mm-hmm. Even though they came on our shores without us inviting them, we must do something to improve their situation, to hurry, to make sure that the process of determining who is a refugee and who is not should be improved, and money should be spent on it. Because otherwise, even if we think from a purely selfish point of view, this is going to be backfire very much, very quickly, because we are treating people inhumanly, and people can't be treated like that.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a question there. I mean, I haven't visited one of the closed centers yet, so I'm not familiar with the conditions at them. But I do know that actually this weekend, there's a delegation from Europe that's come to Malta to report on the conditions. And so sometimes having outside eyes, you know, people from other countries coming, can be a way to motivate us to realize that we can change.
I would like to ask this gentleman, how many times has he been to these camps? I would like to ask him. Because I happen to go there every weekend. I've been doing this for the past 3 years. And I haven't ever seen somebody being inhumanly treated there. I mean, I'm a human rights lawyer, and I help refugees voluntarily. And I go there to help them in their application for refugee status, and the only thing that they complain, it's obvious, it's the long time that they spent there. But I've never seen anybody being tortured, I've never seen anybody being asking for food and not being given food. I cannot understand what he's saying, that these people are being held inhumanly. Can he explain, please? Because I think he's trying to give a very wrong impression of the hospitality that we Maltese are famed for. And we are proud of this because we've never ever, at least from my experience, treated anybody inhumanly in the way he's trying to give this message, because this is not absolutely not true. I mean, I agree that these people should not be prolonged. It's too much, 1.5 years they have to stay there if they are not refugees, if they are, for instance, economic detainees. But they've never been inhumanly treated. I mean, and I think he should justify what he's saying, because I think it's not doing justice to Malta and its and our culture. See,
I would appreciate a short reply and we move on, because this is not really the topic of this evening.
I think that the inhuman, perhaps I want to clarify, the inhuman thing that I'm saying is that they are locked up without, you know, for a long time. They should spend 18 months, and some of them spend longer. And also, other people who have committed crimes can be freed on bail, for example, whereas they can't. I don't think they're being treated well. I'm not saying that there is any torture, but I don't think it's right.
And in all fairness, I think there are reports by, for example, the Committee for the Prevention of Torture, very detailed reports, which are very critical of the situation in the detention center. So,
What I would like to bring about point about the other migrants, which I consider as another type of migrants. They come here to study English, for example, and they get engaged with a Maltese girl, and they marry here, and they take jobs. And most of them are, you know, only married by the registry. And on top of that, they are given low pays for the job. They are paid lesser wages than the others. Well, my suggestion would be, if we use these, you know, migrants, these economic or refugees, which we can issue sort of an identity card and, you know, provide for them or engage them in some work, which the country may benefit, even, let's say, in the building industry, where there are a lot of vacancies. I don't know. What is your comment about this? Would it help?
About the first half of your comment, I haven't studied much. I've only been here for 8 weeks. And so I really haven't studied issues other than, and only, you know, beginning to study issues involving refugees and economic migrants. So I really don't know anything. I can't comment on other migration to Malta. But with respect to the jobs, I mean, maybe to the extent that people, we know that from Catholic social teaching, work is something that people do because it gives them human dignity. People get human dignity out of the work that they do. And so, you know, I think it would be, if there are concerns that people who are in detention are not feeling like they're living with dignity, then maybe opportunities to provide them with employment would be one way of helping them feel better about themselves.
I'd like to make a couple of points. One of them is that perhaps sometimes we confuse the problem of providing, which is a problem, I'm not in any way denying it, from our Christian responsibility to our neighbor, whoever he is, whatever the color, etc. And it includes all kinds of migrants. Whether the state then decides to deal with some in one way or another is a separate matter, but shouldn't change my attitude as a Christian towards that migrant. I think one of the problems we have faced in Malta is a problem that only blossomed with maybe the increase in the migrant problem, because I think, as in any country, I think as in any other place, not just in Malta, there is always going to be some kind of racist attitude. In other words, an exclusive attitude to either a color or a class or of any kind, which is the same kind of thing, excluding some people from being my neighbor. And I think this is a very, very big problem. And we are only facing it in terms of number, perhaps now it's more evident, but I think it is a problem that has been there for a while. And certainly, you know, the gentleman at the front talks about human dignity, not going against it because people are detained. I can't imagine me living with another 100 people in a compound, you know, not being able to work, I think that would kill me. So I would imagine that what I need is very similar to what they need, mm-hmm. apart from the actual status and so on. Now, that's separate, however, from the problem, which is definitely a problem that was mentioned earlier on. But if we're quoting Mother Teresa, I would say that we need to extend our quotation, because Mother Teresa reports once when there was absolutely no food available for the 1,000 or so, 2,000 whatever children that she had to provide for. And for a reason which to this day is not known, the next morning the schools closed for 2 days and all the food provided in the schools were sent to Mother Teresa. So I think we need to have a bit more trust in accepting our neighbor. Now, I'm not talking of, you know, big miracles happening all the time, but Mother Teresa believed in miracles and they happened. I'm not saying that therefore let's all believe in them and they'll happen. That's a simplistic way of looking at it. But I think we shouldn't confuse the solution which we don't have to the basic attitude towards our neighbor. And I think this is getting confused. So just because I'm saying I would accept that person as my neighbor and give him all the human dignity doesn't mean that I don't acknowledge that there is a problem. Just as there would be a problem is if I had 10 children and I was expecting another two. It's not that it's not a problem, but I still think that, you know, accepting them doesn't mean not saying it's going to be difficult or almost impossible. I think they are two separate issues, but as Christians, first we have to accept and then look for the problems, maybe be a bit more creative in the way we look for the solutions.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask your opinion about the way the church in Malta has been expressing its own views on the issue. The anti-immigration lobby has been very vocal, very explicit, and used very strong language in its opinions, both not only in words but also in actions, as we saw in the last few days. And this also led, it also involved the expression of even very fundamentalist and very extreme views in the public domain. On the other hand, the church was, in my opinion and my impression, is that it handled it rather with kid gloves, kind of very cautiously and so on. There are people who believe that the church would have been more explicit, come out much more strongly and sort of stamped out these extreme opinions. And do you agree with that view, or do you think that the church is right in adopting an attitude of prudence and working like behind the scenes through GRS and so on?
You know, it's hard. Actually, as I was preparing this talk, I thought the next thing I need to do is to really educate myself about what the Catholic Church is doing in Malta. I really don't have a basis of knowledge about that yet. I've been doing a lot of work at the university and working with students to teach them about the refugee issue, which is my primary goal here, but the Catholic social thought stuff is kind of my, you know, scholarly passion, but it's not the reason that I was brought here by the Fulbright Commission. So it is something that I would like to look into, and I'd like to maybe even, you know, talk to people at the church and see what their interest is and how they're working. I know a lot about the great work of JRS. And JRS is really, I mean, Katrine and Father Paul are just, I mean, they are really at the front lines of this issue. And it's a very, as we all know, a very complicated issue here with a lot of, you know, emotion associated with it. And you really have to bow down to them and really respect the fact that they're there every day on the front line helping people who are really disenfranchised and are voiceless in the society. So, you know, I know that the Catholic Church is doing a lot through the work of at least the JRS. I don't know enough to address your question in terms of the other work that they're doing. And I guess one other point that I'd make, because there was a lot of discussion about the closed centers, and one thing, just, you know, sometimes we can learn from each other in terms of what people do in other countries. In the United States, we also detain people who arrive in the country without documents, and sometimes they're detained in county jails, and they're detained with other criminals sometimes. But one thing is that the community has really developed. One of the things that I've heard about the closed centers here, and a lot of people have, articulated in one way or another, is just the boredom. I mean, these are people, they're there at these detention centers day in and day out, and they're bored. And so one thing that I would encourage everyone in this room to think about are to do what, you know, the gentleman in the second row is doing, which is to go to these centers and try to figure out ways to, if that's not possible, you're laughing at me. But, but that's something maybe as a community to work on, to try to get access so that you can have prayer meetings, or you can go and do some kind of English as a second language training, or just something so that people can do something with their time, because in the end, they're going to be members of this society or some other society, and we need to recognize that, you know, we can help them to pass this time, these long 18 months.
The places are dirty, and when I say dirty, the migrants themselves used to ask me for bleach and for cleaning materials, because they organize cleaning themselves, but they only have water. Toilets which don't work, showers which have to be used by hundreds of people at the same time. I mean, Catherine can say much more than this because I'm getting, but just to give you my experience, since I've been going to the detention centers, it is still traumatic for me as a volunteer when the gate gets locked behind me every single time. And it is not simply the locking of the gate. It's the dirt, it's the number of people all squashed together, it's the so many languages being spoken and people trying to communicate with you, smile to you, because, you know, we're very few visitors there, but they can't communicate to me, let alone to each other, let alone to the soldiers, who should be informing them of their rights, or I don't know who should be informing them of their rights, but anyway, they kind of do. The number of people who get sick infectious diseases, and when people walk into detention centers, after a few months they become half the people they were, and I'm not just saying this, they're usually people my age, and it's sad to see somebody, you know, not sleeping, not eating properly. I'd say most of them get constipated at some point because the food is not good. And we're not speaking about luxuries. We're not speaking about boredom and giving them something to do whilst they're there. And, you know, we're speaking of people who are frustrated, who don't know what's happening to them. So I'm just all worked up. But I really would like Catherine to mention what the Committee for the Prevention of Torture mentioned in their report, because I think that would be the most adequate answer to the question posed by the gentleman in the front.
One issue, as Daniela mentioned, is the conditions, which are certainly very, they've been criticized time and time again and described very in great detail, I would say, in the report of the Committee for the Prevention of Torture, which is available online. But I think it's more than just the conditions, and I think possibly the worst thing about detention is that in itself it is a policy that dehumanizes and in itself is fundamentally inhuman. One of the most worrying things is the total arbitrariness, and I think this is where there's the greatest level of inhumanity. I'll just tell you one story about a particular individual who was detained, applied for refugee status, and in spite of the fact that he had a very tragic story, was rejected because he didn't fit the narrow criteria of the refugee definition. And he was waiting to be released in line with government policy. Initially after 12 months, because everybody was being released after 12 months, he was taken for an X-ray, and at the last moment the policy changed and he wasn't released. He was told, just wait another 6 months and you'll be released after 18 months. After 18 months he was taken for an X-ray, and yet again he wasn't released. He was told, no, you should have cooperated. You should have gone home. Now, will you go home after 18 months? Naturally, he thought, of course not, and he escaped. Forced into hiding, he left Malta on a boat, but he didn't make it to Sicily to a better life. He drowned. And I just ask myself, couldn't we have done better? No, he didn't deserve protection.
but he did deserve to be treated with dignity, and he did deserve to have the promises made to him respected. Nobody deserves to be promised freedom twice and then not released. And this doesn't happen once, it happens every day, under our noses, in different forms, in different circumstances. There are countless cases I can mention, disabled people detained, pregnant women detained for long months. So yes, I think it is worth thinking and evaluating our policies. It is worth evaluating them in the light of what the Church says about who and what we should be and what other people should be to us.
When I asked Michelle to give this talk, her first suggestion was that it should be on migration issues. And I said that is a very dangerous title because it is the most controversial and people get very emotional, and it wouldn't permit you to expound your thought. And I think she has managed to talk to us about migration issues from a Christian perspective, putting us the big challenge of having this Christian faith with its responsibilities of respecting the dignity of everyone, of trying to answer who is my brother, and trying to answer the question God put to Cain, where is your brother, and I'm not my brother's keeper, and that I think is always the temptation that lurks around us. I'm not my brother's keeper, there is somebody else's responsibility, it's his or her own fault, I can't do more, I'm not my brother's keeper. And that is, I think, the big challenge to our Christian conscience. And certainly the tension for us who go regularly, yes, it is perhaps the biggest issue in all this. Are we as a, let alone a Christian, but are we as a democratic country which enshrines human rights and respect for human dignity in its basic documents, are we happy with this situation? Aren't we able to find out, to discover something which is more humane, besides being less expensive? But we're not talking about that. Trying to find a system that deals with the problem, but deals with it in a humane way, which respects the dignity, while respecting also our justified need demands by the common good. And what happens, as Dr. Azzopardi said, if people don't help us, if others don't help us, does it mean that we are not responsible anymore? I think these questions cannot stop challenging our Christian conscience, cannot stop challenging our civil conscience. And I'm sure that these thoughts that Professor Pistone shared with us will enable us to deal with them even better. So thank you, Professor Pistone. Thank you very much for your presence tonight.
You have just listened to a talk by Professor Michele Pistone, organized by the Jesuit Center for Faith and Justice. The talk is entitled, How Should the Church Sound Its Voice in the Tower of Babel? Perspective on the Church's Social Message.